A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts with earplugs. You see someone else in the office wearing noise-canceling headphones or foam plugs, and you think, oh, they're just like me. We're in the same club. But the prompt digs into why that assumption is not just wrong. It's a case study in how two completely different neurological experiences can produce the exact same visible behavior. And Daniel's been living this, working alongside autistic colleagues while navigating his own ADHD, noticing overlaps that felt familiar, but also gaps that felt like running into a glass door you didn't see coming.
The earplug paradox. I love that framing. Two people, same accommodation, completely different neural reasons for needing it. And the danger is that workplaces are now rushing to embrace neurodiversity, which is genuinely good, but they're doing it with this big tent approach that lumps everything together. ADHD friendly, autism friendly, one size fits all sensory rooms. And if you don't understand the mechanism, you build solutions that miss the mark for everyone.
Build me a chair nobody notices they're sitting in.
The chair that's supposed to help with focus actually makes the sensory overload worse, or vice versa. And Daniel's prompt is really asking us to pull apart why that happens, not just at the behavioral level, but what's actually going on in the brain that makes these conditions look similar on the surface and feel completely different from the inside.
It's the neurodivergent uncanny valley. Close enough to think you understand, different enough that you very much don't.
That's where the personal stakes come in. Daniel describes this relationship with a colleague who taught him someone who was generous with his time, took Daniel under his wing, but the connection never quite landed. There was a frostiness. Jokes fell flat. The warmth that Daniel expected from a mentoring relationship just didn't materialize, and it stayed mechanical.
The Git mentor, who could explain version control in exquisite detail, but couldn't engage with a joke about merge conflicts. That's not a failure of character, or even a failure of connection. It's a translation failure between two different cognitive architectures.
That's what we want to unpack today. Why does ADHD and autism produce these surface similarities? The earplugs, the intense focus on certain topics, the social friction, but through completely different pathways. We're going to look at three axes: sensory processing, attention architecture, and social cognition. And along the way, we're going to get into the actual neuroscience. What's happening in the thalamus, the temporoparietal junction, the dopamine system, but always anchored in what it actually feels like to be in that open office or in that Git session, wondering why the other person isn't connecting the way you expected.
Let's start with the thing that feels most immediate. Why do we both reach for the earplugs? And why does it mean something totally different? Before we get into the neuroscience of sound, I want to sit with that Git mentor story for a minute, because it's the emotional center of this whole thing. Daniel spent hours with this guy, real time, real effort, and the relationship never thawed. And I think that's the experience a lot of people have had without having the framework to understand why.
That's the word that sticks with me. It wasn't hostility. The guy was generous, he was teaching, he was doing everything right in a technical sense. But there's this invisible barrier that Daniel could feel but couldn't name. And I think what Daniel's really asking us is, what was that barrier made of?
He assumed shared experience. He looked at someone who was also neurodivergent, different flavor, sure, but same general category, and projected his own internal experience onto him. We both struggle with sound. We both get deep into topics. We both feel a little out of step socially, so we must be operating from the same basic operating system.
That's the false equivalence. It's the core danger of lumping neurodivergence into one bucket. When Daniel made a joke and the Git mentor looked puzzled, Daniel's ADHD brain probably interpreted that as, oh, he didn't find it funny, maybe I misread the room. But what was actually happening was a literal interpretation of language that bypassed the social cue entirely, not rejection, a different processing pathway.
It's like two people both speaking English, and one of them is processing it through a translation layer the other doesn't have. The words arrive, but the paralinguistic freight, the tone, the irony, the shared cultural wink gets stripped off in transit.
That's what we're going to trace through the brain today. Why does that translation layer exist for some people and not others? What's happening in the temporal parietal junction, in the thalamus, in the dopamine circuits that makes two people who look similar on the outside have such radically different inner experiences?
The episode is really about the danger of assuming. It's about what breaks when you look at someone else's accommodation. The earplugs, the deep focus, the social friction. And think, I know what that feels like, when actually you're seeing the same output from completely different circuitry.
The Get Mentor story is the proof that this isn't academic. A relationship that could have been warm stayed mechanical because neither person had the map of the other's cognitive terrain. Daniel didn't know that his jokes were landing as literal statements to be parsed. The mentor probably didn't know why Daniel kept saying things that didn't make logical sense in context.
Two people, good faith on both sides, and the connection just couldn't bridge the gap. That's the human cost of not understanding these differences.
We're going to walk through three dimensions where the surface similarity masks deep difference, sensory processing, attention architecture, and social cognition. And by the end, hopefully that frostiness makes sense, not as a personal failing, but as a predictable outcome of two brains running different software on similar-looking hardware.
Let's pull on the sensory thread first, because that's where Daniel's prompt starts, the earplug moment. He sees someone else wearing them and thinks, same club. And he's not wrong that there's overlap, but the mechanism underneath is completely different.
This is where the neuroscience gets interesting. For ADHD, sound sensitivity is fundamentally about attentional capture. Your brain can't filter out irrelevant stimuli, so background noise competes for limited working memory resources. There's a network in the brain called the multiple demand network. It's a frontoparietal system that kicks in when you need to maintain focus on a task. And a 2020 meta-analysis in neuroscience and biobehavior reviews found that this network is systematically underactive in ADHD brains during sustained attention. So when Daniel's sitting in an open office and someone three desks over starts talking about lunch plans, his brain can't suppress that signal. It breaks through and hijacks his focus.
It's not that the sound is painful. It's that his brain treats every sound as potentially relevant and has to consciously dismiss each one. That's exhausting.
And here's the tell. Daniel says in the prompt that he can work with earplugs if the noise is steady. A fan, white noise, that kind of thing. That's classic ADHD. Predictable, non-linguistic sound doesn't trigger the attentional capture in the same way because there's no information content to process. But conversational snippets, speech especially, those are like little attention grenades. Your brain can't help but try to parse the meaning.
Whereas for the autistic colleague, the calculus is completely different. It's not about information content at all.
For autism, sound sensitivity often manifests as hyperacusis, where noise is experienced as physically painful or overwhelming, regardless of whether it contains language or not. And the mechanism here is sensory gating at the thalamic level. The thalamus is supposed to act as a relay station that filters incoming sensory information before it reaches the cortex. It attenuates the volume, essentially. In many autistic brains, that gating mechanism doesn't work properly. The brainstem doesn't turn down the dial, so the full intensity of the sound reaches conscious awareness.
The ADHD brain is saying, I can't stop listening to that conversation. The autistic brain is saying, that fluorescent hum is physically hurting me. Same earplugs, completely different war.
There's a 2023 study from Molecular Autism that demonstrated this really cleanly. They exposed autistic participants to repeated auditory stimuli and measured habituation. The normal decrease in neural response when you hear the same sound over and over. Neurotypical brains habituate quickly. The sound becomes less salient. Autistic participants showed significantly reduced habituation. Each repetition hit with almost the same intensity as the first one.
Which means predictability doesn't help. The autistic colleague in the open office isn't going to adjust to the hum of the air conditioning after 20 minutes. It's going to keep landing at full volume all day.
That's the practical difference. Daniel can hack his environment by controlling the type of noise. Steady, predictable sound is fine. Conversational chaos is not. But for his autistic colleague, the very presence of noise, Any noise above a certain threshold is the problem. It's not about focus, it's about pain avoidance.
The earplug paradox in one sentence. ADHD is protecting a cognitive resource. Autism is protecting a sensory threshold. Same visible accommodation. Completely different neural emergency.
This connects directly to the attention piece, because the way each brain handles detail and interest follows the same pattern of surface similarity with deep divergence. Daniel describes having wide-ranging fascinations. He finds a huge number of things interesting. His autistic colleagues tended to have deeper and narrower interests. And he noticed they were often fascinated by details that didn't strike him as interesting at all.
The Git mentor could explain version control in exquisite detail. Branching strategies, merge conflict resolution, the whole taxonomy of Git reset flags. That's not just knowledge. That's a relationship with detail. That's fundamentally different from how Daniel's brain works.
The neuroscience here is about the dopamine system. ADHD is fundamentally a disorder of dopamine regulation. The baseline level of dopamine in the prefrontal cortex is low, which means the brain is constantly seeking stimulation to bring it up to an optimal level. That's why ADHD hyperfocus is interest-driven and novelty-seeking. Daniel's brain finds everything fascinating because novelty itself triggers that dopamine release. The wide-ranging interests aren't a personality quirk, they're a neurochemical strategy.
The brain is basically doing dopamine prospecting. Always scanning for the next interesting thing, because interesting equals neurochemically necessary.
And hyperfocus in ADHD is real, but it's context dependent. It kicks in when something is novel, urgent, challenging, or personally compelling. And it can switch. Daniel might spend 3 hours deep in a new programming language and then drop it entirely when the dopamine well runs dry and something else catches his attention.
Which is not what was happening with the Git mentor.
Not at all. The autistic pattern of deep interest, sometimes called monotropism, operates on a different system entirely. It's less about dopamine seeking and more about pattern recognition and prediction error minimization. The autistic brain finds comfort and predictability in narrow, systematic domains. The interest is content-driven and stable. It doesn't depend on novelty to sustain itself. It depends on depth and structure.
The Git mentor's relationship with version control wasn't about chasing a dopamine hit. It was about inhabiting a system that made sense, that was internally consistent, where every behavior could be understood and predicted.
That's why the details that fascinated him might not have struck Daniel as interesting. For the mentor, the beauty was in the systematic completeness. Every flag in Git reset had a logical purpose, and understanding all of them meant understanding the entire mental model of the tool. For Daniel, the interesting part might have been the practical outcome. What can I build with this? And then his brain would be off to the next thing.
Different serotonin and GABA systems too, right? It's not just dopamine versus something else.
Autism involves different neurotransmitter profiles. Serotonin and GABA are heavily implicated, and the emphasis is less on reward seeking and more on pattern recognition. The brain is tuned to detect regularities and minimize prediction errors. A narrow, deep interest is a perfectly predictable environment. It's not about the rush of discovery. It's about the satisfaction of complete understanding.
Which means, in a workplace context, these are different superpowers with different vulnerabilities. The ADHD brain is incredible in a crisis, or in a brainstorming session, or any situation where you need rapid context, switching, and novel connections. But it struggles with sustained attention on routine tasks.
The autistic brain is extraordinary at depth, consistency, and systematic thinking. The Git mentor was probably the best person in the company to learn version control from because he understood it completely and could explain every edge case. But put him in a situation that requires rapid social improvisation or reading an ambiguous room, and that same systematic processing becomes a barrier.
The trade-offs are real. And the danger in workplace neurodiversity initiatives is designing for one profile and calling it universal. An ADHD-friendly open office with white noise machines and flexible seating might still be a sensory nightmare for an autistic colleague who needs low, predictable stimulation.
Same earplugs, different war. We've seen how sensory and attentional differences can look similar from the outside. But the gap widens dramatically when we move to social cognition. And this is where Daniel's Git mentor story gets really interesting.
Because the earplugs you can explain mechanistically. The social friction feels more personal. You make a joke, someone looks puzzled, and your instinct is to think you failed socially. Not that their brain is processing your words through a completely different pipeline.
That pipeline is what neuroscientists call theory of mind. The ability to infer what someone else is thinking, feeling, or intending. It's not one brain region, it's a network. The temporoparietal junction, the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate. These areas activate when you're trying to model another person's mental state.
In autism, that network runs differently.
Reduced activation, consistently. When an autistic brain encounters a social situation that requires mental state attribution, why did she say that? What does he actually mean? The TPJ and medial prefrontal cortex don't light up the way they do in neurotypical brains. It's not that the capacity isn't there. It's that the automatic inference doesn't happen. The brain processes what was literally said, and the extra step of reading between the lines requires deliberate effort.
Whereas in ADHD, the problem isn't theory of mind at all. It's that the default mode network intrudes during social tasks. Your brain wanders. You miss the cue not because you can't interpret it, but because you weren't attending when it happened.
The ADHD social stumble is about distraction and impulsivity. You interrupt because your brain is already three sentences ahead. You miss a subtle facial expression because a thought about something completely unrelated just hijacked your attention. But if you are attending, you can typically read the room. The autistic social challenge is different. You're attending fully, but the paralinguistic information isn't integrating with the literal content.
That's the distinction that explains the frostiness. Daniel was interpreting the puzzled looks as a failure of rapport, but the Gint mentor wasn't rejecting the social bid. His brain was doing extra work to parse a statement that didn't make logical sense in context.
Sarcasm is the perfect test case for this. Sarcasm requires detecting a mismatch between the literal meaning of the words and the contextual cues, tone of voice, facial expression, shared knowledge about what the speaker actually believes. A 2021 fMRI study in NeuroImage looked at exactly this. They found reduced functional connectivity between the left inferior frontal gyrus, that's a language region, and the right temporoparietal junction in autistic adults during sarcasm detection tasks.
The language center processes the words, but the connection to the brain region that would normally flag, wait, that doesn't match the tone, is weaker. The literal meaning arrives intact, and the ironic wrapper gets dropped.
If you think about what happened when Daniel made a joke about merge conflicts, his brain produced a statement that was literally false, in a way that was supposed to signal humor. The Git mentor's brain processed the literal content, found it incongruent with reality, and got stuck there. It wasn't, I don't find this funny. It was, this statement does not compute.
Which means the mentor probably had a sense of humor. It just operated on different principles. Pattern recognition humor, absurdist humor, systematic wordplay, those might land perfectly. Social irony, where the humor depends on shared understanding of what's not being said, requires that TPJ connection.
The misconception that autistic people lack a sense of humor is one of the more damaging ones. They often have rich humor. It's just that the mechanism is different. If your brain processes language literally first, humor based on shared social inference is going to be harder to access than humor based on logical absurdity or structural surprise.
Like adopting a feral cat.
Wait, are you doing the thing?
I'm demonstrating. That was a non-literal statement with no contextual setup. If you're processing literally, you're now picturing me with a feral cat. If you caught the ironic glare, you recognized it as a commentary on how unpredictable this whole dynamic is.
That's exactly the translation failure Daniel experienced. He kept deploying social irony as a bonding mechanism. It's what ADHD brains often do, because novelty and quick wit are dopamine-friendly, and it kept landing as confusion. Not because the mentor was cold, because the paralinguistic channel wasn't connecting.
Facial expressions are the same story with a different neural pathway. The classic finding is that autistic individuals often look at the mouth rather than the eyes during conversation. The eyes carry the richest emotional information, crinkling at the corners for genuine smiles, narrowing for suspicion, widening for surprise. If you're looking at the mouth, you're getting less of that data.
This isn't a choice. It's an attentional allocation pattern that shows up in eye tracking studies from infancy. The fusiform gyrus, which is specialized for face processing, shows reduced activation in autism. The brain isn't pulling the same richness of emotional information from faces because it's not attending to the most information-dense regions.
Compare that to ADHD. An ADHD brain might look away from a face too, but for completely different reasons. Overstimulation, distraction, the impulse to scan the environment. When an ADHD brain does attend to a face, it can typically read the expression. The machinery works. The attention just wanders.
Same behavior, not making eye contact, completely different mechanism. And this is the core lesson for workplaces. If a manager sees two employees both avoiding eye contact during meetings and assumes it's the same thing, they'll design one accommodation that probably helps neither.
The same behavior, same cause fallacy. It's everywhere in how we talk about neurodivergence. Someone's quiet in a meeting, are they disengaged, or are they processing? Someone's wearing headphones, are they protecting focus or protecting against pain? Someone didn't laugh at your joke. Are they humorless, or did your irony not survive the translation?
The Git mentor story is the emotional proof of why this matters. Daniel assumes shared experience. He projected his own ADHD framework onto someone with a fundamentally different cognitive architecture. And the result wasn't just a misunderstanding, it was a relationship that stayed mechanical when it could have been warm.
Not because either person failed. Because the assumption of sameness prevented the kind of explicit communication that might have bridged the gap. If Daniel had known that his jokes were landing as logical puzzles instead of social bits, he might have adjusted. If the mentor had known that Daniel's humor was a bonding strategy, not a factual error, he might have engaged differently.
The limits of empathy without understanding. You can feel genuine warmth towards someone and still completely misread their inner experience. Empathy is necessary, but it's not sufficient. You need the cognitive model of how their brain actually works.
Which brings us back to those prevalence numbers. About 2.8% of adults have ADHD. About 2.2% are autistic. And the comorbidity is significant. Roughly 30 to 50% of autistic individuals also meet criteria for ADHD. So there are plenty of people who do share both experiences. But that overlap makes the false equivalence even more tempting.
If 30 to 50% of autistic people also have ADHD, then you're going to encounter a lot of people where the surface similarities really do reflect shared underlying mechanisms. And that makes it even harder to recognize the cases where they don't. The earplug paradox gets stickier the more you look at it.
If we accept that these are different architectures, not just different points on one spectrum, but different spectrums entirely, what does that actually mean for how we work together, manage teams, or even just have a conversation?
The first actionable thing is to stop and ask what function the behavior serves. Someone's wearing earplugs. Before you mentally file them under same as me, ask what those earplugs are actually doing. Are they blocking conversational distraction? Or are they blocking sensory pain? The answer changes everything about what kind of environment you should build.
It's the difference between designing a library and designing a sensory refuge. A library reduces information noise. It's about protecting cognitive bandwidth. A sensory refuge reduces all stimulation. It's about protecting the nervous system. Those are not the same room.
That leads to the second insight, which is practical for anyone managing a team. Supporting ADHD focus means reducing distractions and allowing movement. Standing desks, white noise, permission to pace during calls, blocking off deep work time. Supporting autistic sensory regulation means controlling the physical environment, lighting, noise levels, predictability of routines, advance notice of changes.
Same visible need. A better workspace. But the specifications are almost inverted. The ADHD brain might thrive with a bit of ambient bustle as long as it's not linguistic. The autistic brain might need near silence and consistent lighting regardless of what kind of work is happening.
The third one is about communication. If you work with someone who takes things literally, don't assume they lack humor. Be more explicit. Save sarcasm for context where it's mutually understood, and when you're building rapport with someone whose processing style you don't know yet, lead with clarity.
What Daniel's Git sessions needed was a translation protocol. Not less warmth, more explicit signaling. Instead of a sarcastic comment about merge conflicts, something like, "I'm going to make a joke now about how merge conflicts feel." That feels clunky if you're used to irony as a bonding tool. But it's the difference between a joke that lands as confusion and a joke that lands as shared recognition.
The bigger invitation here, for anyone listening, is to reflect on a moment when you assumed shared experience with someone neurodivergent. Maybe it was a colleague, a friend, a family member. You saw a behavior you recognized from your own life and thought, I know what that is. What would have changed if you'd asked about the underlying mechanism instead of assuming?
Not, oh, you too, but what does that feel like for you?
That question, what does that feel like for you, is the one Daniel never got to ask the Git mentor. Or maybe he did, but by then the pattern was already set, and I keep thinking about what we lose when we don't ask it.
It's the thing that stays with me from this whole conversation. Not the neuroscience, not the thalamic gating, not the TPJ connectivity. Though all of that matters. It's that a relationship that could have been warm stayed mechanical, because the assumption of sameness filled the space where curiosity should have been.
That's the open question, as neurodiversity awareness keeps growing. How do we build frameworks that honor both commonality and difference? Because the risk of overgeneralization is real, and it's not just academic. It shows up in workplace policies that treat neurodivergence as one thing. It shows up in well-meaning managers who build one sensory room and call it inclusive. It shows up in conversations where someone says, I'm neurodivergent too, and the other person hears, I understand you, when actually they understand a completely different experience.
The big tent is good. The big tent is progress. But if everyone under the tent assumes they're sleeping in the same kind of bed, we've just traded one kind of invisibility for another.
The next frontier has to be personalization. Not autism-friendly or ADHD-friendly as blanket categories, but brain-specific strategies that start from the individual's actual sensory profile, actual attention architecture, actual social processing style. What does that look like in practice? It looks like asking, not assuming. It looks like accommodations that come with a question mark instead of a label.
It looks like a workplace where someone can say, I need low lighting because fluorescent hum is physically painful for me. And someone else can say, I need background music because silence makes my brain hunt for stimulation. And neither of those requests gets filed under the same policy heading.
That's harder to scale. It's messier. It requires more conversation and less templating. But the alternative is the earplug paradox at scale. Solutions that look universal and miss the mark for almost everyone.
Which brings us back to Daniel's Git mentor. He taught Daniel version control, branching, merging, the whole taxonomy. But the real thing he taught, probably without knowing it, was the limits of assuming shared experience. That lesson cost a friendship that never quite ignited. But it's the thing that makes this whole episode more than an anatomy of two neurotypes.
The frostiness wasn't a failure. It was information. It was two brains running different software, both trying to connect, and neither having the manual for the other's operating system. And the fact that Daniel still thinks about it, still wonders what he missed. That's the right response.
If you've had your own version of that moment, the colleague you couldn't quite reach, the joke that didn't land, the connection that stayed mechanical, we'd actually like to hear about it. Send us your stories of neurodivergent misalignment, or alignment you didn't expect. The emails in the show notes.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, Soviet engineers on the Kuril Islands developed a specialized ice saw with a blade geometry borrowed from traditional Ainu salmon carving knives, a design that was lost after the collapse of the USSR and only rediscovered in 2018 when a retired fisheries mechanic found a rusted prototype in an abandoned warehouse on Paramushir.
A salmon carving ice saw. Of course there are.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.